You are listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast, focusing on the changing nature of retirement today and the non-financial aspects of a successful retirement transition. Join host Joe Casey and learn from leading experts in the field and the stories of people who created interesting second acts as they share practical ideas and tips to create your own. Check out our website at retirementwisdom.com, where you can download our newsletter and other resources to learn more about how coaching can help you. The best way to support this podcast is to head over to Apple Podcasts and post a rating and a comment. It's easy and it's free. Join our conversations and get wiser about your retirement.
Happy New Year, and welcome to Season 4 of the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Casey, and I'll be joined shortly by co-host Dennis Wissman. It's a brand new year, and if you're like us, your thoughts are turning to how can we live this year healthier and enhance our well-being in this new year of 2021. Our guest today is Dr. John LaPuma. He is a practicing physician, board-certified in internal medicine, and a professionally trained chef. His mission is to help you get healthier with what you eat and how you live. Three of his books, Cooking the Real Age Way, The Real Age Diet, and Chef MD's Big Book of Culinary Medicine, have been bestsellers around the world and have been translated into 8 languages. His new book, Refuel, aims to change how men think about what they eat, as fuel too, and to help men become stronger, healthier, and the best versions of themselves. The Wall Street Journal calls him a secret weapon against cholesterol and heart disease. He taught the first nutrition and cooking course for medical students in the U.S. with Dr. Michael Roizen of the Cleveland Clinic, and the first culinary medicine clinical course for medical students in the U.S. Repeatedly named one of America's top physicians by Consumers Research Council, Dr. LaPuma has been honored with the American Medical Association National Association of Medical Communicators Award of Excellence. He is based in Santa Barbara, California. Dr. LaPuma, thanks so much for joining us today.
Great to be with you, Joe and Dennis.
So our listeners have just heard your bio, and I'm sure they'd love to hear more about your story. How did you come to combine medicine and cooking and farming?
Well, with my medical practice for the first 5 or 7 years, I gained a lot of weight, but I didn't really know how to make a healthy diet taste good. And so that's why I went to cooking school. And I loved it. And I loved teaching cooking, both on TV and in the restaurant and to my patients. But I realized after a while that actually soil was the most important ingredient in nearly all foods. So I took a horticultural course to learn permaculture, and that's how they combine.
So you were the first to teach a nutrition and cooking course for medical students in the U.S. What's the state of the medical profession today on its embrace of culinary medicine?
I was lucky to teach the first culinary medicine class with Mike Roizen, who is the founding and emeritus director of the Cleveland Clinic Wellness Center and the founder of Real Age, and now 50% of American medical schools and several medical and family practice residencies and several schools in the UK and the EU all offer electives in culinary medicine. So that's a half hug anyway. It's a half embrace. And we're confident that more will continue to experiment with it and adopt culinary medicine as part of a medical school curriculum. More and more physicians, I think, realize that the root cause of nearly all chronic illness is how we live. Food and sleep and nature and exercise and stress management all contribute to well-being and wellness. And I think you have more control than you think. And most doctors, I think, are beginning to recognize that people believe that too.
So if we're lucky, we're getting older. And I'm curious, what are some of the pillars of a healthy diet from a culinary medicine and an eco-medicine point of view as we age?
Well, as I mentioned, our efforts in Real Age have tried to approach this. The Real Age diet subtitle is Make Yourself Younger with What You Eat, which is a big promise. And Blue Zones, as you know, are the 5 places in the world that Dan Buettner helped to identify with the greatest longevity and greatest quality of life. And so my thoughts about this kind of derive from both of those spheres, as well as from raising herbs and vegetables myself. And so I think the summation of the evidence is that plants and plant foods belong in the middle of the plate and animal foods belong on a side plate. I think the best diet for longevity is omnivorous, but if you make plant food, particularly non-starchy vegetables, not so much corn and potatoes, but more broccoli and beans and tomatoes and leafy greens and fish and poultry on the side plates, then you have the makings for longevity and, of course, great flavors. Another thing that emerges is that a lot of people with great longevity and quality of life don't really drink their calories except for wine. And that is important because otherwise you tend to become overweight or obese, and that not only hurts quality of life, but hurts mobility and energy levels. And then you know about intermittent fasting, of course, and the most recent data about fasting. And I think Longo at USC has suggested that trying to eat close to 12 hours of eating and 12 hours of fasting is a nice pattern that gives the body a rest. There's also some work with intermittent fasting that's much longer than that, 16 or 18 hours with confining eating to a 6 or 8 hour window that seems to improve insulin sensitivity and overall fitness. But I don't know that the latter has been linked to longevity as much as the former. So those are three ways to think about it that I'd work for us.
So you mentioned earlier that we might have more control than we think. And how much do you think the major diseases are preventable, in your opinion, with the right lifestyle modifications?
The CDC actually has addressed that. And they believe that 80% of heart disease and stroke and diabetes and 40% of cancer is preventable with lifestyle change. The CDC is about as conservative an institution in American medicine as exists. I think that almost all arthritis, particularly osteoarthritis, is preventable. I think that loss of mobility as we age is inevitable, but it doesn't have to decline quickly. Having major diseases become and being thought of as preventable problems that can be mitigated is really a game changer if what you're worried about is being sidelined by a critical illness that you don't have the ability to sway the course of. So having more control than you think means that you can make better choices and that they will matter. And after 50, almost all of aging is your choices. Before 50, your genetics have a lot to say. But as if you make it to 50, you can change your life if your habits haven't been good to not just improve your longevity, but improve your quality of life and, of course, your flexibility, your energy level, your curiosity, your cognitive alertness, your ability to communicate. There are a lot of amazing things you can do with lifestyle change.
So knowing what to do and doing it are two different things, as you know, and having the right information is usually a good start, but not enough. As a physician, what have you observed really works in getting people to make the right changes that they need to make in their lifestyle?
The things that work for my patients are like four phrases. One is, what would happen if? I often want or have people who are concerned about others in my office or call me up on the phone and say, I can't get my mom to stop drinking. What do I do? And what doesn't work is nagging. What doesn't work is saying you should. What doesn't work is comparing a mom who's drinking too much to a mom who is not drinking too much. What doesn't work is bullying. What does work is trying to get the person to imagine what would happen if they had two cocktails instead of four. What would happen if they didn't have to spend as much money on booze and had it for other things? That's one. That phrase actually can be applied in lots of other circumstances, which are not necessarily about over drinking, but almost any kind of behavior. Getting a buddy helps. That's the second thing. Mm-hmm. Having a buddy that to whom you are accountable, that's the third thing, is really someone who helps you reconsider bad choices when you're about to make them and prompts you or nudges you to make good choices and often make them a routine. That's the fourth thing. Routine actually helps in making changes, being accountable to someone for those changes and doing it with someone else so that you are not just on your own and are sharing the responsibility really works. There's a last thing which I often ask people to make, and that is identifying a metric. If you measure your success with a metric that matters, weight or cholesterol or number of laps that you run or number of minutes you can play tennis or how long you can walk at what pace, you are more likely to change it. So there's a phrase about measuring what matters. You ought to measure whatever change you're making because then you know whether you're succeeding or not.
People that are challenged with this, and it seems like they have to want to change. They're going to have to admit something to themselves. Is there some way, is there some ideas that you might have that people can start reflecting on or thinking about what's possible for them? People have to want to do this. It's not just going to happen to them, right? They're going to have to admit that they have an issue. Is that fair?
Yes. It depends on what kind of issue is at the core of it. I use the example of someone drinking. That can be an addiction, and it can be over-drinking, and it can be someone who's alcoholic, or it can be somebody who's just drinking four drinks twice a week, and really it's impeding their energy level and their cognition, and they would be better off drinking two drinks twice a week, and they're trying to make a minor change. So addiction is kind of in one area that's quite separate from than most behavior change that I'm speaking of. Most behavior change, and for that reason, the addiction might not have been, or the alcohol might not have been the best example. If, for example, what you're trying to do is get outside more, and if you're getting outside more because you know that it's safer than being inside, particularly in COVID times, and because you want to kind of reset your cortisol levels by becoming less stressed, but you can't make yourself go outside because it's cold and there's snow on the ground and you don't like it and you've never liked cold. So why don't you just stay inside? So for that person has to kind of experience, I think, some of the benefits of being outside while still inside so that he or she will go outside. Like you can, for example, use an app that plays nature sounds, or you can watch Calm on the web and see nature as well as hear the sounds. And that's actually kind of a bridge to being going outside and appreciating the way that the snow undulates and is pretty almost like the ocean is, or hearing the tweets of birds that seem to have disappeared, but actually it's so quiet outside that you can still hear them. So if the question is posed to them, what would happen if you went outside and were and had four layers on? And your down jacket and a warm down cap, then they might not be so cold for at least the first few minutes. And then they could come in after a couple of minutes. But generally, if you're outside for 2 minutes and it's not bitter cold and you got all dressed up, you want to stay out a little longer because you got all dressed up. So what would happen if you went outside and were fully prepared for the cold without a judgment and just listening allows the person to say, well, I do have that down coat, or I do have wool socks, or I did get those cool boots for Christmas last year that are protective against the snow. So what would happen if I went with you? And then it's in their court. It's in the realm of imagination and possibility.
Sure. Well, I think that's a great question people need to ask themselves. That's a great mindset and framework. Thanks for that. Appreciate it.
Sure.
So I've really enjoyed reading your latest book, Refuel. What are some of the unique health challenges that we men types face, and what areas are really most important to focus on?
Men are really different than women, as we know, and as women know. And our medical needs are very different. Our medical statuses are quite different as well. As you know, men die over 5 years earlier than men. We get diabetes at a lower body mass index. We get triple the heart attacks and fatal cardiac events before the age of 64. We have four times the suicide rate half of men get cancer versus just a third of women. From a health standpoint, men really need help. And yet we don't ask for it very well. We don't quite know where to begin. And we're reluctant to even talk about it until something happens. About nearly three quarters of men are overweight or obese. And so that's actually the very first place to start, even though it seems like a really hard place. But the science of it is very compelling. The spare tire around your waist is not just a spare tire. It's an actual secondary endocrine organ. It produces hormones that lower your testosterone levels. It takes the testosterone that the testes makes and turns it into estrogen. And as a result, you have less drive, you're more tired, you sometimes have problems with erection, you have less energy overall, and you kind of feel like a blob, or you just don't have an edge anymore, or a competitive spirit. And that's really disappointing for a lot of men. And it is also correctable, happily, with the right foods and intense fitness and better sleep and better stress management. So the kinds of things that men should focus on are how to get stronger, how to have better sleep, and how to know that people, they'll win if they don't quit. Most of change is actually diligence. It's not just a plan. It's executing the plan and being diligent with it. And some of the advice I gave before about having a buddy and being accountable and having a measurable metric and being and imagining what would happen if you were able to walk a mile instead of half a mile, what would happen if you could fit into the jeans that you fit into last year, this year, what would happen if you were able to have sex twice a week instead of once a week or not at all. And so the areas that there are a lot of areas that men have to focus on that are unique health challenges. But what we can do first and most controllably is change what and how we eat and do so with these behavioral strategies that I've identified. And in our research, this worked really well. And in the thousands of men who have read the Refuel book and written to me, the changes have been remarkable. People lose 10 pounds or more and have better muscle mass and strength and sleep better and just sort of get their lives back. And men have to be given permission for this, I think, because it's not expected of us to be healthy. But that's actually a sexy thing to a lot of women, that healthy men take care of themselves and are proud of it. And so it's been a privilege to help so many people get well. And I'm really proud of the work that we've done and of them.
Big impact. So you were also the first to give a medical lecture on nature therapy at Harvard in their popular lifestyle medicine course. So what role does nature and eco-medicine play in a healthy lifestyle?
Joe, this is a new area of medicine that I'm really proud to be able to participate in. And eco-medicine blends the ancient wisdom of nature with the modern science of medicine to offer indoor and outdoor prescriptions that help us to prevent and treat disease. And most people are unaware that we spend 93% of our time inside, just 7% outside. And, you know, that was before COVID. That 93%, by the way, breaks down into 86% at home and 7% in cars. And a lot of people are unaware that those who have a window in a hospital and look out at trees instead of a brick wall need less pain medication, stay in the hospital almost a day less on average if they have surgery, and have shorter hospitals and better hospital stays overall. Exercise outside is by far the most effective treatment for kids with ADHD, which nature helps with, much more than with medication, according to a study recently of 2,000 parents of kids with ADHD. Even walking outside in a forest can improve your type 1 immunity, the native immune system that you develop when you're a child and that you're born with. And that's your first defense against COVID and other viruses. The antibodies that you get when you're exposed or when you have a vaccine is a second kind of immune defense, but you need the first defense to fend off other viruses and to fend off COVID to begin with. The kind of data that are available for showing how nature is a therapeutic tool, including gardening, is just amazing and is really undiscovered and kind of in smaller journals and groups of horticultural therapists and eco-psychologists who have clued into this, but never really assembled the kind of force that is now being assembled because of COVID, because people have been forced to go outside so much and actually found that there's awe in nature and that that makes their anxiety and depression go away, or at least temporarily relieved and then eventually go away if they develop a program of outdoor activity. So I loved giving that lecture at Harvard last year and have been invited to do it again this year on how nature works as medicine. And I think you're going to be hearing more about eco-medicine. I certainly hope so. And I'm really eager to team up with people who are in this space and want to make a difference, both on the ground with individuals and from farms and vineyards to companies and academic institutions. Because I think this is a kind of a balm for a new age and a way to recognize that the health of the planet and the health of ourselves is a bidirectional relationship. If we help to improve the health of the planet in so much trouble with climate change, we will actually improve ourselves by being out there and participating. And similarly, as we engage in nature to improve our own anxiety and depression, reduce our risk for heart disease, reverse myopia, children who have 45 minutes a day of outdoor play have reversed their myopia in Singapore and Shanghai, where it's now a public health initiative, and an epidemic myopia, which can cause blindness in about 5% of kids, then we will be able to take advantage of this bidirectional relationship and heal ourselves as we heal nature.
You mentioned gardening, and I've read that you grow your own organic fruits and vegetables. And could you tell us about your organic teaching farm and the benefits of gardening?
Sure. Our farm, which is mostly avocados and rare citrus, but is also many other fruit trees, is educational. We teach people who work with us and also young educated people who are seekers, people who believe that reconnecting with nature, as I've talked about, in an intimate way can help them find their inner compass and recover themselves and their direction while also improving the planet. By working outside and interacting with plants and animals. About 85 million people are gardeners in America. And of course, we're very proud of it. In winter here, I have a small greenhouse and radishes and leeks and just planted some broccoli. And that it's just wonderful to be able to touch the soil and nurture things. There are health benefits to gardening, which most people don't know about either, that literature I alluded to. Gardeners have about 37% less dementia than non-gardeners, but no one knows why. Is it because we eat more vegetables and fruit? Is it because we touch the soil? Is it because we're working hard outside and we sleep better and have less insomnia? No one knows, but I'd love to find out. It has been shown that gardens improve your nutrition. Gardeners eat more vegetables than non-gardeners, and they save more money with it as well. Now, it's possible to spend way too much money on nurturing a single tomato plant. You buy the plant, you buy the soil, you buy a pot, you buy expensive fertilizer, and then you get six tomatoes, and each one costs you $27. And that's not great, but it's a way to start learning. You're not doing it because your tomatoes are always cheaper in the store, but there is something that you taste and you feel by growing your own food, even if it's a small herb box and culinary herbs. And rosemary, by the way, is almost impossible to kill, whether it's inside or outside, as long as it's in a window. Then that makes up for those $27. And eventually you become much better at it. When I was in Chicago, I had a coach house in the back of a three flat, and I had a garden, a rooftop tomato garden. And I cannot tell you how many tomatoes I killed in 15-gallon pots. I don't know why I thought I could grow them there, but I tried really hard. And eventually I just thought, you know, this is something I'm bad at. I need to get better at it because I love growing things and I love the flavor of things that I grow. So ultimately, I wound up with a little small urban organic farm in Santa Barbara. And now I kill many fewer things, although I still make all kinds of mistakes.
Yeah. Great story.
So it's not just the end result of the food that's better for you, but it's the process that you're going through.
Totally true. Yeah.
That really gives you the excitement. And it struck me that when you talk about overall wellness, wellness is, and you said it before, I think if I captured it correctly, you said stress management, exercise, eating right, all of that contributes to our overall wellness. One of the blogs on your site that talked about finding out what you really want through shadow journaling. And it was a way for people to actually improve their relationship with themselves, reflect more. And how does something like that, how could something like that help a person achieve a better wellness in their life or a better life in a sense?
As you point out, Dennis, well-being is a really multifaceted concept. It's about, and the behaviors that lead to well-being, which you mentioned, plus being outside and being exposed to nature regularly, including an animal, especially dogs, but also other animals. There were some alpacas, sheep, and goats near my house last week eating a hillside with the alpacas guarding the sheep and goats. Well-being is a kind of multifaceted concept that I think has a reflective component as well. Leading a life that is purposeful is probably the secret to longevity as an attitude. These behaviors, sleeping well, eating well, getting enough exercise, being outside, managing stress, are behaviors that improve wellness. But wellness actually starts, and well-being starts, with purpose, understanding who you are as a person and what your role is in the world in relationship to both other people who you love and to others and to the planet itself. Shadow journaling is one mechanism for reflecting on who you are and what your purpose is, so that you know when you get up in the morning, not just what there is to do, but the reason for doing it. And that reason for doing it is what propels us to a better, richer life that is an inner life, but is reflected in outer behavior. And so that's why I write about it. And I think it's a very helpful activity, as is meditation, where you allow the voices in your head to quiet and you focus on one thing. The phrase I give my patients is, be here now. Be here now, three syllables, is a reminder that all the craziness in the world, and of course we've unfortunately saw a lot of that at the Capitol, is all the craziness in the world is going to be there whether you are there or not. But if you are here now, if you can be here now and just be present with yourself and try to focus on focusing on your breath or on that mantra or something simple, you exclude a lot of the anxieties and pressures that you can feel that make you unhappy and less productive and less creative and less of yourself. So that's where I like to allow people to focus if they can.
Great advice. Thank you.
And I love what you said about purpose being an attitude. It really starts there. So that'll be one of our big takeaways, I'm sure. But I'm still stuck back in thinking about your farming. And I just wonder if I could ask one last question.
Sure.
So what's for dinner tonight?
Let's see. I have some ripe avocados in the fridge, so I'll make guacamole. I just finished harvesting the last of the broccoli from the plants I planted 2 months ago, but there are some side shoots that I trimmed off. So we'll stir fry those and squeeze pink lemon over them. We grow pink lemons that are variegated and really pretty pink on the inside, just sport of Eureka, which is a common lemon in the grocery store. And probably I will roast some wild salmon because you can't grow everything and as much as I'd like to. So that sounds good. And some wine that we made, probably the Roussan from 2018.
Well, I don't know about you, Joe, but I'll bring the dessert and we'll see him at six. What do you think?
Yes, we'll figure it out. Sounds terrific. But thank you so much for sharing all of this with us. And I think it's going to be very helpful to many of us. So thank you for taking the time to do it.
Thank you, Doctor.
Great to be with both of you.
What a great opening conversation for the first one of 2021 and a new year ahead of us. Dennis, what were your takeaways?
Yes, happy 2021 to all of our listeners. A few things from today. First of all, he mentioned about the overall concept of wellness and that wellness was more than just eating right, clearly. He mentioned that stress management exercises, they too also contributed to our wellness. He mentioned the choices that we make, the types of things that we do in our behaviors, and the types of diseases that we get. Some of them are preventable. And we get over the age of 50, we're going to have to make harder choices because it gets a little more difficult to control certain things. Just start thinking about that earlier in life. The whole idea of nature and eco-medicine, and one of the statistics he mentioned was that 93% of our time is spent indoors. But there were tremendous benefits to being outside with nature that a lot of people just don't know about. He also gave examples of how people can get into their mindset, the outdoors, or thinking about how they can get outdoors, even for a little while. And there were tremendous benefits to the forests and nature and being connected with the planet, not for ourselves, not only emotionally and mentally, but also for our health and our immune system. We actually did a podcast earlier with Verla Fortier, who talked about the outside mindset. And these things really kind of crossed over in a lot of ways with each other and reinforced the fact that this is important. We started talking about what would happen if... Dylan, you want to touch on that?
Sure. I think that's a timely topic, given that we're in January and many people set New Year's resolutions. This time of year, actually, it's 60% that do. The sad part is that only 50% will still have those resolutions going by the time we reach January 31st, according to some research I read recently. And only 12% will still be at it 1 year later, 1 year from now. So I think what he's outlining is a better approach. It's a smart approach and holistic approach to overall well-being. And if you think about most of the resolutions, they're usually about well-being in one way or another. And what you should do with the resolution part is to keep that aspiration. What are those things that tie to well-being that you want to do? And then apply his behavioral strategies. He's talked about first starting with purpose, stepping back, doing self-reflection. Not only what you're going to do today, but why. Really checking in on those reasons and aligning with those reasons. And then asking the what if question, the what would happen if? And I think that's helpful for yourself or others you're trying to influence that you care about, to get them in a place of imagination and possibilities, as he had put it. And then really getting into second thing about don't always do it alone. Find a partner, someone who can help support you, and but also not just cheer you on, but hold you accountable to what you said you're going to have. And this really resonates with recent conversation I had with Harry Kramer on the podcast about self-reflection and living a values-based life, holding yourself accountable, but having someone else who can help keep you on the rails and call you out when you're not living up to what you say you're going to do. And then third, something we've talked about in the podcast often, habits. Don't just go with the wishes of a New Year's resolution, but turn them into routines and habits. And we'll put a link to the BJ Fogg podcast that we did a year ago on that method, which I can tell you really works very, very well. And then two last points. He talked about diligence, really that this comes down to what you do, not having the best plan, but having really the action, focus on the actions. And I encourage people just to start to move forward. And again, start small and start in the direction. That would be the big thing. So the last point is really just to look at this year, check in with your aspirations, and use the smartest techniques that are out there to help you get forward. They all go forward. They all start with starting small, and they all have some form of accountability. So those are key things, and we really appreciate him taking the time to talk with us today. And we wish everyone listening a happy new year and wish you a great 2021. It promises to be a much better year than 2020 was.
Thank you for joining us today on the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. You can listen to all episodes of our podcast by subscribing to them on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher, or on our website at retirementwisdom.com.